Chiefs lead 14-7. Mahomes in the pocket, peeling away, being rushed. Now peels back to his right, trying to keep the play alive. Pump faking, fires it late. It's caught in the back of the end zone. Touchdown, Kansas City. Chris Conley with the catch, but Patrick Mahomes with Mahomes magic. Starting left, peeling right. Three drives, three touchdowns for the Chiefs.
I scrambled a lot, but we ran the play. I was getting through my reads, and I scrambled to the left, and then I kind of realized everyone else was on the other side of the field, and so I just turned it back around, and we worked scramble drill this entire training camp, and so those guys kept working for me, and I just found Conley in the back of the end zone, and he caught it and made a good play.
Patrick Mahomes' first ever touchdown pass at Arrowhead, a special one, a memorable one, and a guy that did this all the time back in junior high and peewee football and in high school. Siren Petro joins us now on the program to talk about Mahomes mania. How you doing, Siren?
I'm doing well, my friend. Great to be with you.
Well, I tell you, I saw a video where Mahomes was at a hospital and everybody was going goo-goo and Gaga for Cocoa Puffs. I mean, explain the Mahomes mania. We're out here in north central Kansas, and I think the mania's hit here for Chiefs fans, but in Kansas City, it's got to be at a different level.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, this is, it's. I don't want to belittle what the Royals did, right? Because they're not, the Royals, the Chiefs aren't knocking on the door of winning a championship, but it's like that in the sense that wherever you go, anywhere around town, anyone who knows what you do or knows you is talking about Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs, and more so Mahomes. I mean, it's the Chiefs, but it's Mahomes and the dynamic that no Chiefs fan can remember, at least since Len Dawson, and frankly, maybe ever. You know, Lenny was a very bright quarterback, and they had kind of a new age system, really. They were the Bill Walsh West Coast offense before Bill Walsh. In his book, he's talked a lot about how much he looked at what the Chiefs were doing, and I don't know that Lenny just dropped back and threw rockets. The Chiefs are playing new age offense with a guy who throws rockets, who has other world talent, and I think that has this town giddy because they've waited a year. They were excited about getting their new Christmas present last draft. They got to open it, see it, didn't get to play with it for a year, and now they're enjoying taking it out for a spin.
You know, a lot of people are caught on the touchdown passes, and certainly 13's impressive through the first three games. But to me, the more impressive statistic is zero interceptions. There's so much talk of, Mahomes is going to throw a lot of touchdowns, possibly more than Alex Smith, but he's going to have two, three times as many interceptions. He's going to make some bad decisions, and he probably still will. I mean, it's only through week three of the football season. But, you look back at Texas Tech, it's not like he threw 25 picks in a season or something crazy like that. And the comparison that Mahomes, for some people, have is Brett Favre. And Favre was very reckless of football and had seasons where he threw well over 20 interceptions. Mahomes, to me, that's maybe somewhat of an unfair comparison to Brett Favre.
I would agree. I've talked about the low end of him being Jay Cutler. I feel pretty good he's going to achieve at that level. He certainly seems to have a lot more leadership skills, a lot more charisma, a lot more personality than Jay Cutler brought to it. But that's a guy that had similar kind of arm talent. And the upside being Aaron Rodgers, and I'll stand by that. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of people laughing at me for saying that. I'm like, all right, well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I'm telling you, he's in that range. That's a pretty good floor, to be honest with you, when it's Jay Cutler on the floor. But I think now people are starting to say, wait a minute, there's no way he's going to be down there. Well, I would agree when you're doing things that nobody's ever done, when you're passing names like Peyton Manning and Tom Brady for the records that you're setting, absolutely. And I'm with you. I tweeted about this a little bit last night. I had somebody throwing some questions at me about why are some people sending the narrative out there that this guy was just throwing interceptions all over the place. I said, look, he threw more passes in his last year at Texas Tech, 591 pass attempts, and had 10 interceptions. Alex Smith's entire career at Utah, he had 587 attempts and threw 8 INTs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the quantity of interceptions, you've got to put it in context with the quantity of pass attempts. And so, listen, 10 INTs and 591 attempts with a touchdown ratio that's much higher, I'll take that. And so, I think that's an unfair narrative, and it's a lot of people. The air raid offense came about with teams initially that could not get quarterbacks with the upper-level talent. So they did a lot of the things you've seen the Chiefs do over the last couple of years, bubble screens and short throws and everything, rhythm, timing. And so every one of those quarterbacks, that became the poster child that, well, you know what, if you're an air raid quarterback, you're just somehow damaged goods for the NFL. It's like when college football had a run of like Gino Toretta's and Chris Wankies winning the Heisman Trophy, and Charlie Ward is like, well, Heisman Trophy quarterbacks can't win in the NFL. No, they were good. They were great college players that were just playing a college scheme and beating college defenses. Patrick Mahomes is an NFL talent playing in the air raid, and he's got a coach that will borrow the best of that, but he's not just dinking, dunking, and taking the short patterns on everything. He'll take those, but he'll also rocket it down the field, and he'll rocket it into tight windows in goal-to-go territory. I mean, I think that's one of the things that is very different for the Chiefs now. When they would get in that red zone, they would struggle, and they kicked a ton of field goals. Harrison Butker didn't even get to the Chiefs until, what, week three or four last year, mm-hmm. and he set records for how many field goals he was making.
Yep.
That was because they were settling for three. You're not seeing that right now. Harrison Butker's bored on the sidelines. All he's doing is kicking extra points because when they get into the red zone, the windows get tighter, but Patrick Mahomes has the gun to thread it in there, and I think that's what a lot of people who don't really study and analyze quarterbacks based upon what they're going to be, failed to see that talent with him when he was at Texas Tech.
One of the biggest reasons why I was all for Mahomes being given the keys to the Lamborghini and running the Chiefs offense, and I was all for Alex Smith to be traded, wasn't because I didn't like Alex Smith. It was because, to me, and everybody gets caught up in the big arm, and no question there's a big difference between the two quarterbacks, but what drove me nuts with Alex Smith, and one of the things I said last year on this show when I watched Baker Mayfield play for Oklahoma, and I went out there on a limb and I said Baker Mayfield in college does a better job with his vision and keeping his eyes downfield than Alex Smith does currently. That doesn't mean Baker Mayfield's a better NFL quarterback at this point in time than Alex Smith, but it was just an observation I had. And you look at the great quarterbacks, and I think Alex Smith's a good quarterback. I don't know if I'd call him great. I look at Drew Brees. I look at Tom Brady. I look at Big Ben Roethlisberger. I look at Mayfield, what he did with Cleveland the other night and what he did in college. I look what Patrick Mahomes does, and he did it last year in the final game of the season. When plays break down, those guys don't just immediately tuck it and run or feel an unimaginable pressure. They actually will keep their eyes and their feet moving, and they'll keep their eyes downfield, thus creates the opportunity to make big plays like Mahomes did on that touchdown call we heard earlier.
I believe you are a product of the environment. You're a product of the village that raised you. And Alex Smith being raised as a quarterback, first of all, he does not have the same kind of arm talent that Patrick Mahomes does, and there's no problem with that. Nobody does, frankly,
right,
in the NFL right now. If you were to pick anybody, Rodgers is on that avenue. Matt Stafford with the Lions is on that avenue. If you watch him spin it the way he can throw darts in there, those are the guys that are up there arm talent wise. But you know, Alex Smith came from a run option system, not a throw system at Utah. A lot of what opened up his passing game was the threat of him running. It was much more of a K-State style of offense. In fact, Bill Snyder, it was commented when Urban Meyer was coaching down in Florida, that he has taken our offense, the offense he called it, meaning the offense that he runs and Urban Meyer runs, and gone to another level. And that's one of the things that he learned was watching Urban Meyer when he was sitting out the 3 years in his retirement. And that's what Urban Meyer ran at Utah. He ran a Tim Tebow offense, and that's what Alex Smith got. Oh, his passing numbers are very good. His completion percentage is high. His touchdowns are high. The interceptions are low because he's safe by nature and because he was a threat to run the football every single time, just like Michael Bishop was. But in an NFL system where they can account for you a little bit more and you take bigger hits, that doesn't translate when you go to the NFL the same way it did in college. For Bishop, it meant no career, really, other than being a backup in the NFL. For Smith, it means he goes from being the number one overall guy to being a good game manager, right? A guy that's a system quarterback. Mm-hmm. Throw in that he gets beaten down his first 5 or 6 years with numerous offensive coordinators and head coaches in San Francisco. He gets risk-averse because the interceptions are getting him blown up all around San Francisco. Then he learns to just take care of the football under Jim Harbaugh, not make mistakes. That gets him paid a second time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes to Andy Reid's system. He, again, takes care of the football, doesn't lose the game. That gets him paid again. He continues to do that. He gets paid again going to the Washington Redskins. And you can see that, listen, his mindset is, if I don't turn it over, if I don't take any throw that has any risk in it, I'm going to keep getting a big check. We're going to win a lot of games, and we're going to be in position to make a run at it in the postseason. Problem is, you're not going anywhere in the postseason if you won't make those throws.
Yep.
And that's the difference. The touchdowns have always been the problem. It's not about the completion percentage. It's not about the passer rating. It is about throwing touchdowns. The truly elite in the NFL throw touchdowns. and Alex Smith didn't do enough of it. Right now, Patrick Mahomes is halfway. Through three games, he is halfway to Alex Smith's career high for touchdowns in a season, which was 26 last year. It is night and day what the upside is with Patrick Mahomes compared to what it was with Alex Smith.
And he's done it against the Chargers on the road, Pittsburgh on the road, and against the 49ers. Pretty impressive start for Patrick Mahomes' career as the quarterback of the Chiefs. Seren Petrov, 810 Sports Radio, WHB out of Kansas City, host of the program. Weekdays from 10 to 2, our guest here on the Sports Ticket. All right, let's turn our attention to the defense. Really, to me, there seems to be two storylines every single week after the game. Wow, Mahomes, you're left breathless, and the adjectives, the words fail you. And then there's the defense, which I think we're running out of adjectives to describe it as well. There were some moments where the Chiefs did some good things against the 49ers. I think the 49ers helped the Chiefs out a little bit by taking a lot of time running the football, which actually shortened the game in the fourth quarter, but they were effective running the football against the Chiefs. So I grant you that they had a few really good moments in this game, and they start the game off pretty well to where the Chiefs can get their early lead. But I certainly have my concerns, and it's all over the place with the defense. One, the rush defense concerns me a little bit after what I saw against San Francisco. The lack of pass rush, although it was a little bit better certainly against the Niners, but now Dee Ford might be out for a little while. And then, of course, the secondary. So where do you want to start with the defense, Seren?
Jeez, I mean, you've given me so many wonderful options to choose from.
Hey, Justin Houston got a couple sacks. I mean, that's a good sign.
If you want my honest answer, I'll say pass.
Okay.
You know, and I mean by that, next question. listen, I think at the root of their problems, and it's something we talked about a lot in training camp leading up to the season, I think everybody really focused on the run, and I think the Chiefs' offseason moves were based upon stopping the run. I think they looked at it and said, okay, if we can get better against the run, we can do more things and be more creative and allocate more resources towards trying to protect against the pass. They went out and got Breland Speaks, who's played D-tackle and D-end, and move him out to outside linebacker. That's not unheard of. D-end outside linebacker happens all the time in the NFL, although less now. You know, the days of Mike Vrabel and you know, Tom Bahaliz are fewer because more college teams are playing the 3-4, and they're you know, there are guys like T.J. Watt that play that stand-up attacking outside linebacker in college football. So you don't have to do it as much. But they reached for Breland Speaks, no doubt about it, and they got a 285-pound guy, I believe, to try to stop the run. I mean, he's god-awful at rushing the passer.
Yes.
He takes a false step. Anyone who's been a track coach or played any coached any sport, you know, he lines up with his left foot forward to rush on the quarterback blind side, and his first step is to pick that left foot up and set it back down. I mean, he gives up a first step to an offensive tackle. You've got to explode off that front leg and be getting up the field. And so he's a massive project that they're asking to change positions. And it's going to take time, if it ever comes around, from him. So, but I think what they want him to do is set the edge. Because Dee Ford, he's like, if you had Breland Speaks and Dee Ford and you mashed them together, you'd have a good player.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you'd have a guy who can set the edge, which I think Speaks can do against the run and did in preseason, and you'd have a guy who can get to the passer with an upfield pass rush, which is what D4 can do. You'd have a pretty damn good player. You'd probably have Melvin Ingram from the Chargers if you could put the two of them together. The problem is, unless you can get them in extreme down and distances, like a second and short where you figure they're going to run, or a third and short, or a goal line, with Breland Speaks is out there, drop back and throw. He's not getting to your quarterback. He's an easy one-on-one pickup. Hell, you can pick him up with a tight end over there. And I think teams are going to start to do that and shade their protection the other way to protect against Justin Houston. I would. If you've got a decent blocking tight end, you will handle Breland Speaks easy in pass protection. And vice versa, you turn around, and if the run is an option on the down, you'll freight train Dee Ford. He couldn't set the edge on me. I'll hook him, and we'll turn the corner on a running play against Dee Ford. So, you know, they did things to improve against the run, Anthony Hitchens being the biggest move, and they have improved against the run. So I do think that's better, and I think that's noteworthy when you consider that they're going to play a lot of position defense and be hopefully protecting, and so far exclusively been protecting leads or tie games. That makes it easier for them to play defense. But I think their coverage was actually the bigger issue, and people didn't realize. You know, they talked so much about the run game being 28th against the run, but they were actually 29th against the pass.
Yeah.
And they weren't a good coverage team with Marcus Peters.
No.
So the fact that they're bad now without him is not shocking. And frankly, I don't know that they're a whole lot worse without him. Yes, they don't have that one guy that just could take away the side of the field, but you don't really have to try to throw away from one side of the field anymore either now, right? So they've given up a little something. Instead of just working exclusively on the other side, I think they've gotten better with Steven Nelson being on the opposite side. Kendall Fuller does a good job in the slot. But safety-wise, they've got issues. And their coverage, Anthony Hitchens can't cover anybody. He's given up virtually a perfect passer rating when his guy is targeted in coverage. They've got real issues there. So is there hope? Yeah, the hope is that Daniel Sorensen and Eric Berry come back, get healthy, and really improve the at least the middle coverage part of the field secondary-wise. They'll certainly help even more against the run because they're both good run defenders for their position. But I don't think there is a good answer. You're going to have to win a lot of boat races this year, and I think that's why the comparisons to 2003 are very good ones. The difference, I think, between this defense and that one is I do think there's better overall talent, if it's healthy and on the field, which has been a big question for Eric Berry and Justin Houston. But if you look back to that 0-3 Chiefs team, they were led in sacks, 5.5 sacks by Bonnie Holiday led the team. Eric Hicks had 5. A guy by the name of R. Cal Truluck had 5 sacks.
Oh, wow.
For that 2003 Kansas City Chiefs team. I mean, there was no Justin Houston roaring around the edge, and there wasn't even a Dee Ford on that defense. So I do think they have the potential to get to the quarterback better, but Bob Sutton's got to do a better job of scheming, which theoretically he did in getting 4 sacks last week against the Niners.
About 7 or 8 minutes left here with you, Sarin. I want to get to Eric Berry's situation, and then we'll get to our final 4 for you. I do that just for you, Mr. Petro.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
I know you enjoy that. Eric Berry's situation. What's the latest? I mean, I think it's comical that we hear doubtful. I mean, come on. He hasn't even practiced. He's not going to play. When they bring out the injury report, we know he's not going to play. He's got to, at some point, get back on the practice field. What do we know about Eric Berry's situation?
Well, Jeff Chedia, who comes on with our morning show, the Border Patrol here every week, and he writes for NFL.com, does a fantastic job, was on, and he wrote a piece a couple of days ago, and I think he's kind of gotten word that he feels like the Jaguar game is the game they're targeting. Now, I think we'll know a lot more today if Eric Berry practices. The Chiefs, under Andy Reid, have pretty much had a good rule of thumb. Now, if anyone's going to blow this up, it'll be Eric Berry. So if he doesn't practice today or this week, don't hold me to this. But the rule of thumb with Andy Reid is you practice Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then you sit out the game. They see how you are after going through the practices. Then you come back and you practice Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or next week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, because it's a Monday night game, and you would go in that game that you had 2 weeks of practice after. So that, you know, that would speak if the Jaguar game, which Jeff kind of hinted at, he was getting the vibe that that's what they were kind of targeting for Eric Berry. If that's going to be the case, we'll probably see him out on the practice field, but don't jump to a conclusion that he's definitely going to play against the Broncos. So I think it better be the Jaguars, right? The pup list was available. If he's not going to play against the Jaguars, that's 5 games missed, and you could have had somebody else playing. You could have had another roster spot being used for him if you'd put him on the physically unable to perform list, which they did not do. So at some point, their medical staff is going to have to really answer some questions if he continues to miss weeks, because I'm assuming the medical staff said, no, he's not going to be out 6 weeks. You don't need to pup him, and they didn't do that. It'll be a mismanagement of their roster if he doesn't come back and play at least by Jacksonville.
Real quickly, chances the Chiefs could acquire Earl Thomas from the Seahawks?
You know, I think the what would I say, comfortable comedic nature that Andy Reid fielded questions about Earl Thomas from us on Monday makes me think that he doesn't think it's going to happen. You know, if they were in some intense negotiation where they were haggling over what draft pick comes back to the Chief or how the compensation's going to work, and they were just, you know, really trying to nail down the final pieces of the puzzle, I think he would have been very defensive and very closed about his comments. Instead, he smiled and joked, and, you know, I talked about the theory, because he can't mention Earl Thomas's name, you know, the theory of acquiring guys in season and what challenges does it present and can it work. And he acknowledged, well, I know there are rumors out there, and he went through the theory of it all. Then Adam Teicher from ESPN said, well, we are talking about Earl Thomas. Can you confirm that? He said, there are rumors out there, and he laughed and joked. Having covered Andy Reid since 13, I don't think he does that if he feels like a trade is on the brink or close to happening. I think he keeps his mouth shut. So I don't think it's going to happen. For it to happen, I think this is what's really important for Chiefs fans to understand. He would take up really basically all the cap room that they have left this year, which means you're going to have to renegotiate with somebody to create some more cap space for when somebody goes on the IR and you have to sign some guys for the league minimum just to get through the season. You need $2 or $3 million to be able to pick up, you know, minimum veteran salaries along the way to get through the year. So they'd have to restructure some things. But the big picture is, you know, if the report's true that the Cowboys offered a second-round pick and that wasn't good enough, the Chiefs are going to have to offer at least a first or a second and maybe both seconds this year, or a second this year and next year. That's a steep price to pay for a guy. And if you're going to pay that, you're certainly going to want to re-sign him, right? So you're going to be re-signing him for age 30, 31, 32, 33 years old, and you're going to be blowing up a cap that is already pressed up against it for the 2019 season. And if you're going to get a decent price on Tyreek Hill, Chris Jones, or Kendall Fuller, all three of those guys should be signed this offseason. If you're not going to make the mistake that they made of having to pay beyond market value for Justin Houston, for Eric Berry, after paying the franchise tag, you get it done a year before they get to free agency and give them that financial security that makes them willing to take less than what would be the maximum deal. If those guys get to the final year of the deal, they're going to free agency, and you're going to pay massive prices. You're going to pay a massive price on Tyreek Hill already, but it will be out of this world if he is able to get to free agency. So I would say this. You can want Earl Thomas. We all want everything right now, right? I'd like a Lamborghini right now.
Me too.
But not at the cost of being kicked out of my house in 2 years. So if you sign Earl Thomas, are you willing to wave goodbye to Chris Jones or Tyreek Hill or Kendall Fuller or a couple of them and or Eric Berry, Justin Houston, who may have to be cut to create cap room for this team? Plus, not signed, already not signed for next year. I mean, it's not just what is looming over the horizon, but off next year's team, Mitch Morse isn't signed. Steven Nelson isn't signed. When we talk about being up against the cap, that's without those guys being under contract. So, you know, and there's, and listen, I could go, there's actually 20 guys on this roster. Alan Bailey, who aren't signed. Dee Ford isn't signed. There are a lot of guys that you've got to replace. Ron Parker and Orlando Scandrick, who are starting players on this team, are not signed. It just, cap-wise, I don't see how they can make it work. I'll be really surprised if they make a deal.
Usually do off the wall to end our interviews, but for you, final four. So are you ready, Mr. Petro?
Yeah, let's do it, my friend.
All right, man. Number one, Mahomes' final TD to interception numbers this year.
So I think coming in, I started at 27 and 13 because I wanted him to talk Alex Smith's best go-round. We got to the season. I said, what the hell, I'm going to go. I'm going to have him break Len Dawson's, which is god-awful, that 1964, 30 touchdowns, great year by Len Dawson, in 14 games.
Yeah.
Right, people talk about, you know, how bad 36 home runs was for the Royals. That lasted from 86. It's been since 1964, the only season that a Chiefs quarterback has thrown 30. He blows through that. I'm now going to go ahead and take him to get the first 40 touchdown season. I'll say 40 and 12 when it's all said and done.
40 and 12, got it down. Royals make the playoffs again in what year?
I think 2021. That's the timeline it took for the A's to rebuild and turn it around. And I would have said maybe longer until some of the baby Royals really started producing down the stretch. Although, don't read too much into September numbers; they can be one of the fool's golds of fool's golds. But I do like what I'm seeing, so I'll say 2021.
Extra question here, real quick: yes or no? Ned will be the manager next year for the Royals.
I'm gonna say yes.
Me too.
I get that he wanted to guide the franchise through the rough patches, and this was certainly the roughest of the rough patches. I'll put it at 51-49 that he's back, but if I have to pick one or the other, I'll say yes.
All right, third question, our final four. Best guest you've ever had on your show?
Best guest ever on my show. Jim Harbaugh. I had him on after his first year with the San Francisco 49ers when he won the 101 Awards, NFC Coach of the Year. Unbelievably honest and frank. A real challenged interview because there are a lot of long pauses where you're not sure if he's hung up when he's just kind of thinking about his answers, but incredibly honest. Talking about, I asked him about how competitive he was in a father-son basketball game, and you could hear the intensity, right? He's like, I told my son, that T-shirt you won, that's a championship T-shirt. They can never take that away from you. I'm like, it's a father-son basketball. I mean, supposedly he has a kid playing with a fever because they weren't going to quit the tournament. He confirmed, basically, without definitively saying, but that yes, he was going to take the Kansas job, but Lou Perkins wouldn't let him coach the bowl game and take the job. It was unbelievably honest and frank. It was a great conversation, and it's definitely the one that sticks with me the most.
And finally, your number one team in college football is?
It's the Clemson Tigers. Much to the chagrin of Paul Feinbaum, who I was a guest on his show because I'm now the only Associated Press voter that doesn't have Alabama number one. In fact, I have number three. I have Georgia at number two for a lot of reasons that I won't go into. yes, I have Clemson number one, and I will stand by it. And frankly, I don't see it changing without a Clemson loss and a Georgia loss. I don't see Alabama getting to number one because Alabama hasn't played anybody. That's the biggest thing. I mean, why should I penalize Clemson and bump Alabama up when their biggest win is beating a Texas A&M team that most people don't think is that good?
Well, if before the season that was your pecking order and those teams keep winning, I don't see why you have to change it. So I'm with you on that.
My man Paul Feinbaum, he doesn't agree.
Well, I don't care what he thinks. And he doesn't seem to care what you think, even though you tried to explain logic to him, which he doesn't understand. But that's another day, another show. All right, finally, how do people listen to the program? How do they can listen to your show and get it online, buddy?
Yeah, 810WHB.com, and you can download our 810 app at the app stores, wherever you go for that. And you can catch us from 10 to 2. And follow me on Twitter, at Soren Petro, S-O-R-E-N-P-E-T-R-O, if you're interested. And then you, too, can ridicule me for not putting Central Florida in the top 25 or having Alabama number one.
Always enjoy it, buddy. Thanks for the time. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Wade, you're the man, buddy. Thanks for having me.